Influenced by the message music of Jamaica's Jimmy Cliff and Peter Tosh, that's South Africa's Lucky Dube with his prophetic song, You Stand Alone. It's from his 1999 album, The Way It Is. Lucky Dube was killed during a carjacking in Johannesburg, in the Johannesburg suburb, I should say, of Rosettenville. On October the 18th, 2007, he was 43 years old and the father of seven children. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And it is true. If you tell the truth, you invariably will be standing alone. The current administration is the exact opposite. If you don't tell the truth, you have more than enough company with you. Well, I want to talk about the teachable moments that we have been experiencing lately and why there's a missing element to these teachable moments. To African-American men, Rashawn Nelson and Dante Robinson, both 23 years old, were arrested April the 12th at a Starbucks in Philadelphia after the store's manager said they were not paying customers and were not entitled to any of the upscale cafe's amenities. In other words, they were trespassing. After protests urging a national boycott of Starbucks, the men have reached undisclosed settlements with the parent company, and each has agreed to a $1 symbolic settlement with the city in exchange for $200,000 to be given to support a program for minority entrepreneurs. Two Native American men were part of an organized tour of Colorado State University on Monday when campus police showed up and detained them for questioning. A white woman who was on the tour with her daughter had called in a report that the Native American men on the tour were, quote, making her nervous, unquote. The Denver Post reported this story yesterday. After campus security questioned the men, they left the tour and the campus and returned to their home in New Mexico. The CSU officials tried to reach out to them to apologize, but it appears the damage has already been done. Just two examples. And here is the reason I'm citing these two examples. Because we are encouraged to believe that, yes, these are very nasty events. They should not have happened, but they did. Lapse of judgment and management and people who are conducting tours of a university and so forth. Okay, we get all that. But nonetheless, even with all of the even with all of the transactions going on, the undisclosed settlements and disclosed settlements and all of that, all of the reports of feel-good efforts to make up for what clearly was a crazy set of attitudes. That's not the story to me. That's not the story to me at all. We even had a recent story of a young man who worked at the White House, at the Obama White House, Darren D. Martin. This is just this past Friday. Attempting to move into his new apartment, he relocated back to the city of New York and got a walk-up, a fifth-floor walk-up apartment, and was just trying to move in. And found himself surrounded by six cops, guilty of moving while black. Somebody, when he asked, well, what are you guys doing here? Somebody, he was told by the cops, somebody in the building called in a report of a burglary in progress. And with the possibility that the person that they were talking about had a large weapon. Okay. So this is now getting me closer to my point. I am saying we have to question in all of this, although they apologized again and it became clear that he was not trying to break into anybody's apartment. He was simply trying to move into his own and all of that. In the immediate situation at Starbucks, at the University of Colorado, in the Upper West Side, as they're calling Harlem these days, you know, a man is moving in, and it was all a mix-up. Okay. But look at the role of the police. In each instance, in the very middle of all of this, when some kind of judgment could have been made as to the legitimacy of the complaint and the request, I mean, at the Starbucks, the manager demanded that the police arrest two people who had committed no crime. And what did the police do? The police moved in and arrested two people who had committed no crime. Nothing in their training gave them permission to arrest two people who committed no crime. But they did anyway. And they did so at the direction of this white female manager, who essentially was the choreographer of this whole distasteful event. I'm not concerned about whether they settled or didn't settle or whatever it is they wanted to do. I'm saying, look at the role of the police in a situation where they're responding clearly to a situation in which a white female, it could have been a white male, it would have made no difference in that sense, but somebody white called in a complaint, and automatically the police switch from keepers of the law to a goon squad. Suddenly they have no independent sense at all of what was the right thing to do in any of these situations. Nobody of the platoon that responded to Starbucks and this crazy manager who said that these men were trespassing because they were waiting for a friend to come to meet them there so that they could have a meeting about a business project. One crazy woman picks up the phone and says, "We want these people out of here." Is that the job of the police? To obey you? To not question your prerogatives or desires? To be, in effect, your private goon squad? There's nobody on the whole police department who at that very moment was able to evaluate the situation and determine pretty quickly this was not the role of the police. The role of police was not to effect an arrest for trespassing because the manager of the establishment has determined that they must go. By what law? You see, so I don't pay attention to what comes afterwards when they've figured it out and everybody wants to hold hands and sing kumbaya and people want to make settlements and whatnot. Let us look at the role of the police in the specific instance. They should have been the ones to subject the manager to questioning. By what right, by what law do you insist on putting people out of your establishment? By what law? By what right? Because that is justice when you do your job right. She clearly wasn't doing her job right. And she had control over the cops. The cops proceeded not to do their jobs right. I find it fascinating that no one is questioning the role of the cops here. And by the way, the fact that the cops did not do what they were supposed to do, it meant that these men's lives at that moment could have been in danger. If they decided at that moment to assert their rights to be in Starbucks, it could have gone from just, "Look, fellas, let's just keep this thing cool and sort it out later, but for now, you got to leave." It could have gone way off the rails if those men who would have been correct to assert their rights, if they did just that. Some woman, it's a college tour. These two young Native American men decided to participate in an organized event. They didn't just pop in. This is an organized event. And they had as much right to be there as this crazy woman who decided she was so fearful. She was fearful of the fact that two Native American men were on the same tour as she and her precious daughter. They're all trying to figure out, is this the right school for me? But no. The interference comes because this woman suddenly is insecure and fearful, i.e. racist as hell. And she had the power and the authority by herself to change all the rules and to make it possible for her to prevail so that she can feel secure. And these two young men who were there also to figure out whether this was the right college for them, they came on the tour. They were not strangers. They were not unexpected. They were part of the organized tour. She is insecure, so they had to go. Now, what role did the police play in this? Afterwards, a lot of phone calls went back and forth, and the college president was so apologetic. I don't care about that. First of all, I think they should sue the pants off of these folks. Get as much money as you can. Sue them to the hilt. But I'm talking here about the role of the police, which we seldom discuss in matters that go bad, real fast, and very often end up costing people their lives. Why should, because a white woman is insecure and she's so afraid because two people who owned, who were part of the First Nations people that owned all the land in Colorado, that they should come along on a tour, an innocent thing like that. And you with your messed up mind, your horrible racist attitude, get the police involved, and the police essentially do their bidding. These two young men should not have been forced or felt the need to remove themselves from seeing to their future. They're there looking to see whether this college is the right place for them. They cleared out. They left the tour. They went back home. Nothing happens to this woman. And the police are okay. Of course, everything is post facto. They make the calls all afterwards. The college president is so upset. And I don't care how upset you are. Why is it that in order to arrive at a point where we have a civil society, the victims have to first play the role of rehabilitators, and secondly, absorb the cost and the costs and the penalties to make this world better? It's not their job. And here we see the example of how the police themselves express their own internalized racism. The word of any complainant who is white against any complainant who is not is what they follow. This young man is trying to move into an apartment. He's coming back to the city. And he is met up with six cops. Of course, they're all armed. What if he were to have reacted in a different way? He would have been endangering his own life. The cops didn't feel obliged to check out the complainant. The cops acted only on the information they had from the complainant. They didn't talk to this woman. They didn't interview her. They didn't ask her, what did you see? What did the person look like? And she gave all these details. A person carrying a large weapon. That man could have been shot down like a dog in the hallway, just trying to move into his new apartment. And all because the police refused to do the job that the police ought to do. And as much as you are responding to a complaint, the complainant is right there in the building. Go knock on the door. Hello, Miss Complainant. Tell us what you saw. What did the guy look like? No. They are so trained to hate people of color that they can use information from a piece of paper taken down by whoever took the complaint at the precinct. And on the basis of that alone, they can show up armed and ready to arrest this person if he resisted at all. He would have been putting his life in danger. Now, this is often the missing equation in a whole bunch of things that end up with people getting killed. And we see over and over again, these are just three recent examples. Why should two Native American men trying to get their lives together, involved in very, very plausible and encouraging work of going to see a university as part of a planned tour? Why should they, after police questioning, nobody asked the woman, well, what the hell are you doing here? They're doing the same thing. Why does she automatically have rights and privileges that these two young men do not have and don't enjoy? Why should they be snatched off the tour and be subjected to close questioning by the campus police in order to see how close the complainant came to the accuracy of the complaint? They're not responsible for somebody feeling so intimidated by their mere presence. They've become so fearful. And then it is legitimized. Nobody asks them. Nobody asks this woman, why are you so fearful? Why do you have reason to be fearful of these two men? Nobody asks that question. She's entitled to be fearful. And because she's entitled to be fearful, they must comply with being sequestered, moved out of this tour of a college. Their purpose and their business cut short because they were there to evaluate the college to see whether it was a match for them. And they're the ones under the gun, literally, until they just decided, we don't need to be here. And that, too, is a function of police. The police function usually is raised when somebody is dead. Well, how did he end up dead? How did he end up dead? Very often it's these trivial matters that are compounded by the police not subjecting the complainants to the kind of scrutiny that they automatically subject the innocent people to. I've seen so many times cases where this happens, and it still continues. And then we hear, after some kind of confrontation, as with the Starbucks case, isn't it nice that they're all together, these two young men? Isn't it nice of them to be so generous and so kind after being treated the way they were treated? Isn't it really a very laudable thing? I'm not in the business of trying to be laudable. I don't care whether people think I'm laudable or not. The question is, at the very moment when the police presence at Starbucks should have produced an entirely different result, which was to ask the manager, well, what are they doing wrong? Did they break up your saucers and cups? Did they steal some of your macchiato? What did they do? I'm asking you because now you call the police, you call us the police to effect essentially an eviction from a store on the basis that they are trespassing. Nobody asks the manager, what does the word trespassing mean? Here, right now, what does it mean? Define it. Define how it is that these people must be removed from the premises, and we, the police, are to be the people to effect the eviction. How did that come to be my role? How did it come to be the case that you, the manager, get to tell me what I'm supposed to do to make you happy, even if it is not really within the confines of the law? You see? So we have these unspoken truths that upon coming into a situation like this, the police come into it predisposed to doing the bidding of a white person at the expense of the black people. There's no question being asked. There's no rationale being demanded. Constitutional rights, did you say? Who has constitutional rights? Constitutional rights are given and approved of by the manager, the crazy woman. She is the one who is now the arbiter of constitutional law at the University of Colorado. A fearful racist woman is the person who's calling the shots, because they allowed her to. And they allowed her to do so because immediately it is recognized that she's the one calling the shots. Nobody has questioned her. Ma'am, how long have you been crazy? How long have you been a racist? How long have you harbored these racist feelings about Native American men? Why do you think that we are to obey your rules or your requests to make you feel safe in your racism and to remove them from the campus when they're here to do the same thing you're doing. Why should they go and you stay? You come to arrest a supposed burglar, six cops with guns. People don't even understand what that was. That was a moment of true terror. Some crazy white tenant in the building makes a complaint. A squad is dispatched because no doubt the complaint included a physical description. Well, you know, he's one of them. That person does not pay a price for making a racist complaint. Instead, the police, in order for her to feel safe, the police now switch the agenda. Her agenda is now what is literally governing everything. And this is where we are. This is the basis of a lot of the transactions between the police and we, the citizens, or us, the citizens. The cops are not in charge. Nobody has any direction from higher ups in a police precinct as to how they are supposed to respond. People make complaints all the time. That doesn't mean they are the law. It could very well be that they themselves are breaking the law. But we have to end this cycle of the victims of racism themselves having to rehabilitate or pay the price for rehabilitating their racist attackers, their racist exploiters. That's not our job. And we have to get to this question of what is the standing order when police officers are dispatched in order to investigate a crime or an alleged crime or a complaint. Under what power are they operating? That's the question. We'll take this break and come back and talk a bit more about the Cosby case, whether he did get a fair trial or not. We have a development in that regard today with Mrs. Cosby firing off a very, very serious letter concerning that very question. We'll do that right after we come back. Holy book tells us. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. You know, it is interesting that in so many situations we are ahead of developments, or we are following, or we are creating a kind of reference point in terms of developments in particular cases and so forth, where it looks like other people are following what it is we're talking about. But, of course, that is just serendipitous. People do this all the time. But Camille Cosby the wife of Bill Cosby, wrote a scathing 3-page statement that was printed today about the case and about her husband's conviction just last week in a Philadelphia court. And I will read you the article, and I would read you as much of the statement as I possibly can, but she's asking the same question. In fact, she is answering the same question that we are asking. Was this a fair trial? Her answer was an emphatic no. She says, this trial was about mob justice. Let me just read the account. This was run in USA Today. I'll read you the article. Camille Cosby, Bill Cosby's wife of 54 years, excoriated his accusers, prosecutors, media, lynch mobs, and mob justice Thursday, in the first official statement from the Cosby household since the ex-TV icon was found guilty of sexual assault 1 week ago. Quote, once again, an innocent person has been found guilty based on an unthinking, unquestioning, unconstitutional frenzy propagated by the media and allowed to play out in a supposed court of law, unquote, Camille Cosby said in a 3-page statement issued early Thursday, that's today, and emailed by Cosby spokesman Andrew Wyatt. Quote, this is mob justice, not real justice. This tragedy must be undone, not just for Bill Cosby, but for the country, unquote. In her statement, Camille Cosby invoked the Constitution, likened her husband to martyred Emmett Till and other black men falsely accused of rape by white women, declared that accuser Andrea Constant and dozens of other Cosby accusers lied, and blamed all his troubles on the media with their, quote, frenzied, relentless demonization of him and unquestioning acceptance of accusers' allegations without any attendant proof, unquote. Quote, I firmly believe Constant's recent testimony during trial was perjured, as was shown at trial. It was unsupported by any evidence and riddled with innumerable dishonest contradictions, Camille Cosby's statement said. Constant's lawyer, Dolores Troiani, issued a brief response Thursday morning. Quote, 12 honorable people, a jury of Cosby's peers, have spoken. There is nothing more that needs to be said, said Troiani in a statement emailed to USA Today. Camille Cosby said media coverage of her husband since the fall of 2014 has violated the 5th and 14th Amendments, which guarantee due process and equal protection, and thereby eliminated the possibility of a fair trial and unbiased jury. Bill Cosby was labeled as guilty because the media and accusers said so, period, unquote, she said. She also called for a criminal investigation of the prosecution team led by Montgomery County, Pennsylvania District Attorney Kevin Steele. Quote, this is a homogeneous group of exploitive and corrupt people whose primary purpose is to advance themselves professionally and economically at the expense of Mr. Cosby's life, her statement said. quote, if they can do this to Mr. Cosby, they can do so to anyone, unquote. Camille Cosby, 74, was little seen and rarely heard during her husband's two trials on charges of aggravated indecent assault stemming from an encounter with Constant at his suburban Philadelphia home in January 2004. I have a very bad cold, so bear with me. Cosby's wife issued only one public statement defending her husband after dozens of women began coming forward in October 2014 to accuse Cosby, 80, of drugging and or raping them in episodes dating back to the mid-1960s. She appeared at the first trial last year just once, and at the two-week retrial for the closing statement of her husband's defense team. Bill Cosby is now a convicted sexual offender, confined to their suburban Philadelphia estate with a GPS monitoring device and awaiting a pre-sentencing assessment as, quote, a sexually violent predator, unquote. He could receive 10 years in prison on each count. His sentencing is expected in about 70 days. He has said nothing publicly since he was convicted on April the 26th. Well, there you go. She, in effect, is raising the same questions that we are, and on one level you can say, well, look, this is the man's wife. Of course she's going to be supportive. Of course she will raise objections like this. But I also am asking the questions. I'm not coming to any conclusions. I'm thinking we should ask the questions. And we should see or try to get some answers and see whether, in fact, this was a fair trial. Now, we're not yet getting into the details of the case. That comes in a minute. But what we're looking for and what we have been discussing, if you review quickly how far we have gotten with these discussions, you'd see these are the very questions. Without any prompting, without any coaching, these questions naturally arose in response to the big question that I asked. Did Cosby get a fair trial? I didn't ask whether he was guilty or not guilty. I still am not asking whether he's guilty or not guilty. I'm asking, was the process fair and lawful? And so we have some time. We can continue at 888-874-4888. We can take a couple of calls. I do apologize for my sniffling, but hey, we're tough. We can continue. If you don't really understand what I'm saying, say so, and I'll just try and clean up the sniffling a little bit. But this is the question. Our question is not about whether he's guilty or not guilty. Our question is whether the process was legitimate. And if the process was legitimate, I could rest easy with the outcome. But I'm very uneasy because in assessing how this trial occurred and what preceded the trial, I'm uncomfortable with stating emphatically this was a fair trial. I don't believe it. And this is where ultimately we will go. Michael from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrice, and welcome to the family.
Thank you.
PRN. I, something struck me, Utrice, when I was thinking about this, and not just thinking about this particular case, but, you know, what we've been discussing for a long time involving the unequal distribution of justice, just generally, and between people of color, minorities, and the established white minority or population. Yeah, I mean, we've been looking at this for a long time, and you, as you go along, if you collect a lot of data, like a scientist will collect a lot of data, and then some patterns start to emerge from all this data that's been collected as you go on and on, seeing case after case. And something struck me particularly with this particular case of Bill Cosby, and also the many cases where African Americans in particular, but people of minorities, have been seeking justice, seeking a remedy for an injustice. And it seems like all the time we're looking at these cases of African Americans being seeking justice for an injustice, mostly by police that we've been discussing, unnecessary deaths, injustice kind of thing. And then the family seeks remedy. They have to choose. These people have to choose between a settlement and justice. You can't have both from their perspective. They have to either, go the Sharpton lawyer way and get a settlement, and then they don't get justice. Or if they seek justice, they probably can't get it anyway because of the civil rights kind of case that would be brought, the bar, they keep saying the bar is too high, we can't take the case, and they can't get justice that way. So they have to resort to a settlement. But they get no justice. They get the settlement, and they call, and some people may say call that justice, but it's not. They have to choose between justice and a settlement. Now we get to the Bill Cosby case, and however ambivalent I might feel about maybe the process of the trial itself was okay, maybe not. And we could discuss that more. But something is different here. Here's a white woman who's getting both. She's getting her cake and eating it too. She's getting justice and a settlement. She doesn't have to choose. She can have both. But everybody else that we've been discussing as we've been collecting data going along has to choose one or the other. And I'll listen to your comment on that.
Well, it's an interesting observation that you raise, but you see, it's not her. There is a system. A woman's system, a woman's rights system has developed. There are people who are pushing it and funding it and are behind it for all kinds of reasons. It's very complicated, and we must take a look at it. And that is why Constant, by the way, is half Greek. The interest, the intense interest that women have shown, and as you know, I had said early on, and this was related to other cases, I had said that Gloria Allred should be disbarred. She's not functioning as a lawyer. And she has a vested interest in the development of this movement. And they did all kinds of very shady and shoddy things to cut corners in order to defend some women in order to, get a victory of against very public and very well-known men. So we will get to that. It's not even so pure and clean. It's a dirty fight. And that element was part of this fight. It still is. Thanks. Willie from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hello? Hello, Willie. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Utrecht. Good afternoon.
How are you doing? Thank you.
And Pierre and family.
Thank you.
If you're in your right mind, anybody, you should know that there was no such thing as justice. When you go into these so-called court of law, it's just us. And they're telling in their own words. We go in there looking for justice in the criminal justice system. Okay. They're telling what it is. It's a system run by a bunch of criminals. We are the ones who are crazy. They're telling you in their own words. Look, what they've done to Bill Cosby, they've been going, I remember they killed his son in California. Remember that? And Ida B. Wells came to prominence through the same very thing. Men, black men, who she knew commit these acts against white women. But it's just a way of taking their money, that's all. This is a historical thing. So it's nothing new.
The thing is this. I am satisfied if we can get very, very close to as broad an understanding as possible of how the system works. We're not trying this case again, although, right, of course, elements will come into the conversation. But we're looking at this system and how before our very eyes, they're pulling fast ones over us all the time.
Not us. Because I really don't, I don't pay any attention to this. Because, no, this is how it works. Tyson, you name it all the way back. 20 years from now. Because you think.
We're getting cut off, Willie. I'm not hearing you. Okay. Well, in any event, we only have a short time if you take another call. Jeff, you have a short time.
Well,
yes, you're on the air, Jeff, from New Jersey.
Hey, how you doing? Yes, it started with another black comedian saying in his show, talking about Bill Cosby and rape. And there's nothing funny about rape in a comedy show. How did this video get taped when you cannot tape performers inside of comedy clubs? How does this video get taped and then sent out? So you can begin with there, and then the dirt seemed to just continue to follow. So the campaign was put out there to make him guilty automatically. And just to say things to people who says, oh, he admitted to giving women quaaludes, that's what you did. Right now there is a song called Shots, and that song says when we give women shots, they like to perform oral sex on us. The panties drop. So are these young men who are singing this song right now going to be bought up 30 years later for giving women alcohol, getting them drunk, and having sex with them? Are they going to be brought up on rape charges? Because right now in every single university in America, you can be charged with rape if you have sex with a drunk girl, even though she consents.
Well, here's the thing. We don't know. And this is what I'm hoping that we could all accept. We don't know what the truth of all of these things, what the truth is. We are concentrating instead on how this case unfolded and how it was handled and how it arrived at a predetermined conclusion.
Right. And
I am not,
again,
sufficiently confident in the fact that I know all the facts of this case. So I'm not going to espouse the facts of the case.
Well, I wouldn't argue that.
If you bear with us and you go along with the idea, we will discover things as we go. But let's start trying to discern or to discover just what kind of trial did he have. Thanks so much for calling, all of you, and thank you so much for contributing. That brings us to the end of the program. Tomorrow, of course, is Free Your Mind Friday, and we're open to talk about anything. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.